This is the WGBH Forum Network.
In keeping with the theme of our current exhibit, Baseball as America, tonight's special guests are renowned baseball insiders, though you won't actually see them on the diamond, and I'm very excited to introduce them. Rarely has someone in baseball who is not a player or manager been profiled in The New Yorker, featured on 60 Minutes, and named to Time Magazine's list of the 100 most influential people in the world. One of our celebrity guests has, and for good reason. Bill James pioneered sabermetrics, giving us many new statistics through which to look at players and teams, and in the process, he himself has become part of baseball legend. Through his search for objective knowledge about baseball, he completely changed the way many people see and understand the game. His work on player evaluation, player development, and baseball strategy revolutionized baseball analysis and overturned decades worth of conventional wisdom. As The New Yorker said, Bill James is a philosopher hero who brought baseball out of the dark ages. Our second celebrity guest has been called the most popular sabermetrician not named Bill James. Rob Nyer landed a job with Bill James and never looked back. Nyer has been praised for making statistical formulas human. Like Bill James, he's interested in the people who play the game, as much so as he is in the stats. In his many books, he has shared stories about pitchers and parks, legends and lineups, managers, and memorable moments. According to Bill, Rob knows baseball history like a child knows his piggy bank. He knows how to pick it up and shake it and make what he needs fall out. Many of you know him as senior writer for ESPN.com. He's also a regular on ESPN Radio and ESPN News and makes frequent guest appearances on sports talk shows around the country. Please join me in welcoming Bill James and Rob Nyer.
We decided to say a few things about ourselves. I'll keep it brief because we're running a little late. And most of the stuff that I would tell you about myself is in the program. But just a brief word about how I got started in this business. When I was a freshman in college, I walked into the University of Kansas bookstore, and I was obsessed with baseball. Had been for years. And I found this book, the Bill James Baseball Abstract. And I picked it up and started leafing through it. And although I couldn't afford food at that time, I knew I had to have this book. I was captivated. Took it home, basically finished it in, I don't know, a couple of days at most. And I was hooked. I was hooked on baseball analysis and specifically on Bill's writing. Didn't help me a lot in college. I didn't study much, and I watched a lot of baseball games. If you'd asked me what I wanted to do with my life, I had one answer: work for Bill James. I had no idea how a person would do that. What I didn't know is that Bill lived about a half an hour away from me, and we had a mutual friend. So shortly after I dropped out of college, I discovered that Bill was interested in hiring an assistant. I applied for the job. I've never understood why Bill hired me, but he did. And I worked with Bill for 4 years. Then I worked for a company called Stats, Inc. in Chicago. And in 1996, I went to ESPN.com. And what I've been telling people is I've written more words for the site than anybody, which may or may not be true, but nobody's contradicted me yet. And that's how I got here.
My name is Bill James. I started writing about baseball in 1975. I wrote the first article and sent it off actually the same day I asked out my wife for the first time, August 1st, 1975. The sort of those things like Back to the Future, where everything was happening at the same moment. My original idea was I do not have training as a scientist, and I would never describe myself as a scientist because I don't have the background or experience or the training of a scientist. But what I was trying to do when I started writing about baseball was to bring to the disputes that baseball always has a kind of scientific discipline, so that I would pick up the same issues that everybody else was talking about and try to break them down into small and measurable things and try to understand how the measurable parts fit together, a sort of comic strip imitation of the scientific method. So I'm very flattered to be here in the Museum of Science, and as if it was what we'd done to become an actual science. And I thank you all for being here. And is this time to go yet? Oh. Rob has a list of questions which he will read from, and we will discuss.
Yeah, I've got 10 or 12 questions here. We're going to get through as many as we can, probably until about 10 till 8, and then we'll open it up to the audience for Q&A. I'd like to start off with a question that Bill came up with. Bill, what is the Dick Allen problem, and what can sabermetrics tell us about that?
Well, what sabermetrics can tell us about it now is very little. I don't know how many of you know who Dick Allen was. Dick Allen was a very talented baseball player in the 1960s whose career was followed by troubles. He had great difficulty getting along with managers and owners. He was not a bad guy. He was a very charming man, extremely well-liked by exactly half of his teammates. I'm using Dick Allen to stand in for the question of how do you measure off-field influences. We're very, very good at documenting the things that a baseball player does on the field to help his team win. We're so good at that that many people have fallen into the habit of denying that there is anything whatsoever that a player can do off the field which has any relevance to his value. This seems to me to be an idiotic position. I mean, no matter what you do for a living, can your coworkers make you more efficient or can they make you less efficient? Can they help you get your work done better or interfere with it? Of course they can. It's almost inconceivable that you could have a job which was immune to interference from the coworkers. But many people, when it comes to baseball, many people are inclined to deny this. In fact, I once got a long letter denying this from a good friend of mine who was a Marine general, and said to me the proposition that there's no such thing as leadership is an extremely strange position to be asserted by a Marine general. So I guess the question is, how do you measure that? How do you measure that interactive effect? And can you document it? And do you believe that it exists in the absence of a way to measure it?
Well, the easy thing to assume is that when you see conflict around a baseball team, that it's definitely going to be damaging. In fact, just recently there was a fight on a team. I think it was the Tampa Bay, Deionor Navarro and one of his pitchers got into a little scuffle. And I would do a radio show, and people would say, well, this must be a bad thing, right? And you have to have a short memory or be young to forget, you know, how often the Yankees in the 1970s fought. So it's very difficult to just see a team and say, oh, this must be bad that these guys are mad at each other, when it doesn't – maybe it is bad, but it hasn't kept lots of teams from winning.
Yeah, I'm very glad to hear that little dust-up between Euclid and Manny didn't make it to Portland, by the way.
That one was discussed, too.
I was relieved. You're hard to argue with you because you're so intelligent. And the way you stated that, you dodged my next 3 points. So I don't know what to say now. But what you said is that many people assume that any sort of dislike or conflict between players has to be counterproductive to the efforts of the team. And that's exactly the problem. That's not always true. Very often, conflict between players is productive and is useful and is a part of the winning dynamic. The real issue is that there are a very wide range of behaviors. What I keep hoping that somebody will step forward with is a theory of how this works in other workplaces that can be applied to baseball and somehow studied. There must be, given all the business schools in America, people who can categorize types of employees, types of relationships among employees that are counterproductive, and can explain to us how this applies to a baseball roster. but I've never seen it. What we're trying to get to is areas in sabermetrics that are unexplored, things that we can still learn from. And that's the most obvious one to me, because there has to be some way to think about this in an organized way, but I don't have any idea what it is.
Let me shift gears for a second, and I want to talk about relief pitchers. I noticed this year, and it's probably true last year as well, that the innings pitched for the best relievers, the closers, have gotten almost as low as they can possibly go. Basically, all the top closers this year are going to top out around 70 innings. 20 years ago, it was 100 innings or 95 innings. I don't think we can go much lower than 70, because they're basically all coming in now when they have a save situation, and you're going to have 45 to 50 per season. So I guess you could go lower. I know that in a computer simulation, you want your best pitchers to pitch more often than 70 innings per season.
Right.
But in the real world, for a number of reasons, some of which might make sense, some of which probably don't, managers are reluctant or usually unwilling to use a pitcher in a non-save situation. Have we taken this as far as we can go? Or do you think we'll see a closer 5 years from now pitching 55 or 60 innings?
I think if you check, we've probably already seen closers pitching 55 or 60 innings. I would answer it this way, that if you study the way that relievers are used in baseball now, as opposed to 10 years ago, it's very, very different. If you go back to 1998 and look at 1998 as opposed to 1988, it's very, very different. Can everybody hear me, by the way? Is anybody having trouble? 1988 as opposed to 1978 is very, very different. I am certain that what we're doing now is not optimal. And because it's not optimal, it will continue to evolve, so that 2018 will be very different than 2008. The direction in which we're heading probably is not the perfect target, and the curves will bend before we get there.
I mean, we're reaching the point where every team is going to have 12 or 13 relief pitchers. I mean, there is a limit, right? I mean, how far it can go. But I don't see it reversing. It seems like it's almost got to reach a point, and then it has to stop, but nobody seems to want to go the other direction. I mean, the smartest teams in baseball have not shown any real interest in reversing this course.
We are reaching one of those points where I really don't want to hear this on the radio in the morning. but I'll try to answer your question as honestly as I can. One thing that I never understood at all until I actually worked for a baseball team is the extent to which managers always want more relief pitchers. And the reason for that is that when a manager brings in a new pitcher and the pitcher fails, people blame the manager. And it's irrational. I mean, it wasn't the manager's fault we had a lousy bullpen in 2003. I mean, when you bring in a reliever and he's bad, people blame the manager. So the manager always is very, very conscious of what his bullpen is. Not saying who it is, but there are people in our organization who, if it was possible to have a shortstop who doubled as a relief pitcher, we'd have one.
I want to talk about this is actually one of your questions, about the quality of play between the leagues, the relative quality. For those who don't know, the American League, what I call the big boy league, has been quite a bit better than the National League for at least the last 2 years, actually three, plus this year. This year, I looked it up a couple days ago, the AL is way ahead of the National League in interleague games, which doesn't necessarily mean anything, but when it happens every year, you think that it probably does. And it might just be an interesting oddity, but it really does matter. For example, if you're thinking about trading for a player from the other league or signing a free agent, I don't know to what extent it matters, but I have to think that if the league is much worse than National League, that has to impact your evaluation of the players from that league, doesn't it?
It does, but I think that the real problem is that it doesn't as much as people think it would. I slipped this question, the relative strength of leagues, into the stack because it seems to me that it's something about which there's a great deal of misunderstanding. And I'm not talking just about the I wasn't intending to speak just about the American and National Leagues, but although that includes that, but about, for example, AA as opposed to A ball. I remember talking to a guy in our organization, asking him the question, how large is the step up from AA to AAA? To which his answer was, it's huge. It's far larger than the step up from AAA to the majors. The I'm almost certain that he's wrong about that. But on the other hand, he played AA and played a little bit of AAA, and he works in a farm system, and he's had that experience lots of times of trying to help people across that bridge from one to the other. And he's, so in a way, he's a better position to know than I am, but I still think he's wrong, which is a summary of my life. I know you guys know more about this than I do, but I still think you're wrong. So it seems to me that there has to be... This issue comes up all the time when you're discussing amateur players, that there'll be a player who's very good in a bad league. He doesn't play in one of the big college leagues. He plays somewhere else. And somebody thinks, oh, well, okay, he's hitting 450 or 520 or whatever he's hitting, but it's, against that level of competition. My impression is that people overvalue the differences. I mean, I know that one can't reasonably deny that the American League has pulled ahead of the National League. But my argument is that while that difference is very apparent on the team level, on the individual level, it's not that significant. It just seems to me to be an area about which somebody should be able to do a whole lot better research than we've been able to so far. Perhaps it's somebody here has the experience to explain to me how I can do that.
Well, I've been interested in this league difference thing for a while because it occurred to me, I don't know, a few years ago that the National League was probably a lot better than the American League in the late 50s and early 60s.
Right.
But when we go back and look at the players from various eras, and particularly that one, when we're talking about the Hall of Fame or whatever, we just sort of assume that they're all in the same environment.
Right.
And they weren't in the same environment. And it may well be, go back and look, a friend of mine has done some work on this, if you go back and look at the players who say we're in the top five in MVP voting in the American League in 1961 or two or whenever, and you look at the guys in the National League who are in the top five, no comparison. And it makes you wonder how good Al Kaline really was, for example. When we talk about the Kaline versus Clemente debate, maybe it's not as even as we thought because Kaline was in the lesser league.
Well, as someone who spent all of the 1960s denying that the American League was inferior, I have experience with that argument. It was really a painful subject to. And I understand National League fans now because I grew up in the 1960s and I got really tired of hearing how much better the other league was. But I would argue that a difference that is hugely apparent on the level of teams and is immensely apparent on the level of leagues is not that significant when you put it on the much broader spectrum of skills that distinguishes players. We're talking about things that are unknown, things that we should be studied, so we can never really...
Yeah, one could take Al Kaline and put him in the National League and see what he does, and I don't know that anybody's done that yet.
He's like 74.
All right, Jason Veritek, when he caught his fourth no-hitter, I believe setting a record, people were asking me, is he the greatest defensive catcher ever? What does this mean? I don't know what that means, but I do know we've got a long ways to go when it comes to evaluating catcher's defense. Calling pitches is tough because some catchers don't call their own pitches. Passed balls and wild pitches, well, it depends on who the pitcher is. A lot of the time. Framing pitches. I'm not a big believer in framing pitches at all, but people sure talk about it. What can we say about Brad Ausmus and Jason Veritek and what they mean above and beyond the stats we can see?
It is my general philosophy that we have little islands of knowledge in a sea of ignorance. The whole idea of discussing the things that we don't know is sort of misleading because it implies that we know most things, and we're just trying to figure out these sort of residual things. That is an area that, you know, it's sort of like we're crawling toward the sun. And in that area, we're really not even crawling. It's the progress we're making in figuring out. We have a lot of tools now to study that we did not have 15 or 20 years ago. We have records of every pitch, and I don't mean just records of whether it's a ball or a strike, but rather records of whether it broke 16 inches or 12. And whether it was 2 inches outside or four. We have really phenomenal records. In time, somebody will organize ways of thinking about those records that are useful in evaluating catchers. But I just think we're an awfully long way away from the point of, you know, I don't know if I'm going to live to see it, or Al Kaline will either, for that matter. And also, I mean, Jason is in a sense a bad example because that you're mixing up the leadership issue with the catching issue. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of Red Sox fans, I would like to see Jason in the Hall of Fame someday. He doesn't do the things that Hall of Famers do, but his contribution to the team in a different way is enormous. And there have been cases where there was a paradigm shift in how people thought about the Hall of Fame, and those type of players became eligible. You'd like to think that we can approach measuring those things, but in a sense he's a bad example because it's not only his defensive skills but also the leadership that we don't understand either one.
Since we're here, one of the things that's happened lately is there's this new tool called PitchFX, which is just come into use in the last couple of years. Essentially, there are cameras in many or all of the ballparks now that track the ball's flight from the pitcher's hand. Actually, they track the pitcher's hand as well to the catcher. And for example, one of the many things that it will do, it would allow us to answer the question: Can catchers get a pitch by framing it? For those who don't know, framing means to set up in a certain way or to catch the ball in a certain way that essentially steals a strike. You'll hear broadcasters talk about this all the time. They'll say, well, if he hadn't been so smooth on that one, it would have been a ball, but since he was, it was a strike. I umpired seventh grade baseball games when I was a teenager, and I never did that. I mean, for me, it was where the ball came across the plate, and I've always assumed that real umpires do it the same way. Maybe that isn't true. Maybe the ball's coming in so fast or with so much break that they do pay attention to the catcher. But what you could find out with PitchFX, I think, is does that happen?
Right.
Do some catchers get more pitches called strikes that shouldn't be than other catchers? Nobody studied that yet, as far as I know.
That's right. There are some guys that you can see just watching. There's some guys that are really bad at this because they're too obvious. Like, you
know. Right.
It doesn't work.
I'm sure that does. I personally don't think it ever works. I'm not convinced that it does work. Tim McCarver thinks it works. He was a catcher. I mean, he would know better than I would, but I'm still skeptical. But I think we actually could find out. And this PitchFX stuff, I think it's the biggest thing that's happened in baseball analysis since Bill hit the scene 25 or 30 years ago. It's just opened up this entire new vista for answering these sorts of questions. Umpires, for example, umpire tendencies. All we could know before was basically, do these guys call more strikes than these guys? We've known that for a while, but now we can know which guys call the inside pitches, the high pitches, and I would guess that would be useful to major league teams to know that stuff.
But not to shoot down one of our future questions, but we don't have that much time anyway. The thing about umpires is that as soon as we study it, the effect that we study will disappear anyway.
It should.
But it will. I mean, as soon as we document that a certain umpire is a pitcher's umpire, or as soon as you document it, the effect will disappear anyway. So there's a real social scientist have a word for that. It's like the something effect, where you change the nature of a thing by studying it.
Is that the Heisenberg principle?
Got me.
Never graduated. Let's talk a little bit about young pitchers. How you develop them in the minor leagues, how you keep them healthy. What do we know? What don't we know?
The
Red Sox, by the way, tell me if I have the wrong team, but I believe the Red Sox haven't had a major arm injury in their farm system in some years. Is that true?
I don't know. We have arm injuries. We drafted a, and I'm blanking out on the name, but we drafted a kid last fall who started out his career pitching 11 innings of shutout ball last fall, and then started this year pitching like 18 innings of shutout ball, and then had Tommy John surgery. Everybody has arm injury. Kid still has an ERA of 0 after 2 years in college in pro ball. We have arm injuries and major arm injuries. There may be somebody who hasn't had any. What I can tell you is that an immense amount of effort and energy and thought is given to preventing them. But I wouldn't be. Again, I think it's an area about which what we know is not too rich compared to the list of things that we don't know.
Just to follow up on that, I mean, I remember writing 10 years ago that teams could save millions and millions of dollars every year if they could just solve a small part of that problem. It seems like there has been a real change in the way teams work with their young pitchers. For example, 10 years ago, Clay Buchholz would have been assumed that the Red Sox will get 200 innings out of him this season if they can. And that we don't see that anymore. Buchholz, the Red Sox weren't going to get 200 innings out of him, even if he had pitched well. I'm assuming he would have gotten a rest at some point. Jabba Chamberlain, Yankees did the same thing. And that's basically become the new paradigm with young pitchers, is that you're not going to increase their innings over a certain number.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of things have been tried over the last 10 years, but then sort of discarded because people said, you know what, we tried that. It didn't work. The six-man rotation of the minors didn't work, so now we're going to move on to the next thing. It seems like this is sort of settled in as conventional wisdom now.
Well, that's right, because, hard knowledge drives out soft knowledge. I mean, somebody was able to demonstrate clearly that the injury rate increased among pitchers, and I should remember the name, but I'm bad with names. Somebody was able to demonstrate clearly that the injury rate for pitchers accelerates sharply when a pitcher increases his innings pitch by more than 30 innings a year. Well, there's a lot of problems with that bit of knowledge, right? I mean, it's probably not simply the increase in innings that's causing it. It's probably an increase in innings under pressure, an increase in innings under fatigue. There are probably 10 factors you could pull out of that, but it doesn't matter. Somebody established that if you increase innings that rapidly, you have a higher risk of an injury. And, I mean, we're not taking that chance, right? We don't know what it is. We don't really understand the problem, but we understand that much of it. So we're going to go that far in trying to prevent injuries.
I'm not sure how we get science into this part of the discussion, but Bill raised it. I thought it was intriguing. Right now, the fans seem to be sort of powerless in the baseball world. You got the owners, you got the players, who are just as powerful as the owners in many ways, and perhaps the media. I think they play a role. Can the fans play a bigger role in this relationship? And how would they do that?
There's what is either thought of correctly as a tripartite arrangement or a nobody says quadripartite, but I don't know. A four-sided arrangement. There's either in sports rest on agreements either among players, owners, and fans, or if you want to think of it that way, players, owners, fans, and media. And I don't know which is the better way to think about it. In the 1970s, 1960s and the 1970s, our friend Marvin Miller, organized the players and increased their power greatly. It seems to me that as an objective principle, it has to be true that there must be some way that the fans could increase their power in that relationship and improve the sports world. The problem is, how is that done? I mean, it's an issue waiting that they're waiting for somebody to study it. But and by the way, we have representatives of the ownership here, Red Sox ownership here tonight, so maybe I shouldn't have brought this up. But the is it possible? You're more clearly a member of the media than I am. But is it correct for the fans to think of the media as their representatives in this three-cornered battle? Or is that as much a delusion as when the commissioner says, I speak for the fans? That's one issue. Some people believe that the way for the fans to get more power is through legislation. That is the responsibility of the government to speak for the fans. That frightens me, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the wrong answer. Maybe that is the right answer. For example, in the issue of fans being whipsawed to fund the building of new stadiums, it seems to me it's entirely appropriate that, you know, in essence, the citizens of St. Louis are put in a position where they're told, unless you build a new stadium for us, we'll take your sports team away from you. It seems to me it's totally appropriate for the federal government to step in and say, you can't do that. The federal government in that case would be acting on behalf of the fans. I'm just posing the question, is there a way to study this issue? Is there a way to think about this issue that I'm missing? Is anybody writing about it in a way that's in the vast and wonderful blogosphere? Is anybody doing really good work on this particular issue? That's what I'm trying to get to.
Well, you know, I always go back to what Bill Veeck wrote about baseball fans. If you rely on real baseball fans, you'll be out of business before Memorial Day, right?
Right.
I don't think there are enough real fans, the people who are here, to affect any real change. And in fact, when you talk about legislation, it's the non-fans who would, I think, typically drive that sort of legislation. The fans typically are happy to pay for the new ballpark, at least many of them. It's the non-fans who don't want to spend the money.
Right.
So, well, I think we're stuck as fans.
I doubt that. I mean, I think that there was a point at which the players said, I think we're stuck. There's really nothing we can do about it. And then along came Marvin Miller, and he had a game plan, and he had the skills that he needed, and he increased the power of the players in that relationship. I would bet that at some point in the next 100 years, somebody will come along with a plan to increase the fans' power in that relationship and will succeed in doing it.
All right, coaches. The question that comes to mind is how do we evaluate coaches? Do we have any idea? Do we know if they do anything? You look at hitting coaches. They go back and forth from team to team. It's almost impossible, at least as far as I know, to notice any correlation between who the coach is and how well the team hits. Another question, let's say you found the greatest pitching coach ever. Would you want him at the major leagues, or would you want him in A-ball? Coaches tend to move up as their reputation grows. It might be that the best coach is the most valuable teaching 18, 19-year-olds as opposed to Greg Maddux.
Right.
Will we ever know anything about coaches?
I know that John Farrell is a heck of a lot better than the guy we had before. I liked him. He was a nice guy. This is an area of study in which sabermetrics needs to borrow from other established disciplines. I mean, it seems to me it's beyond my pay grade to study statistics and see a relationship between the effectiveness of a coach and performance of a team. I mean, I've never been able to do that, and I really doubt that anybody else can do that. It seems to me that there are so many factors which influence the performance of the team that to isolate the one factor and say this is the constant key is pretty speculative. There was a guy who worked really hard on that problem. Remember when Lee Mazzilli was the pitching coach in Atlanta for many years, and Atlanta's pitching was tremendous, the greatest.
Leo Mazzoni?
Did I say Mazzilli?
Yeah.
There you go. I told you I was bad with names. Mazzoni, and Atlanta pitching in the 1990s was the greatest ever. Somebody wrote a long article attributing this to Mazzone,
The Mazzoni effect.
The Mazzoni effect. Mazzoni wound up getting a nice contract to go to Baltimore, but their pitching didn't get any better. And maybe he was really good. The calming effect. But I don't know. It seems to me this is an issue in which, in order to get traction in studying the issue, we need to be more creative about borrowing from research done in other fields.
Can you give us a little window into the process by which a coach, a hitting coach, or a pitching coach is actually hired, evaluated in the first place?
I have to be a little careful about what I say, but I think that the front office gossip has a lot to do with it. The early stages of it involve a lot of who's looking to move and what do you know about this guy from people who worked with him. I would say this. I think the biggest difference between one of the biggest differences in the Red Sox now as opposed to 3 years ago is the quality of our coaches is way ahead of where it was a few years ago. And I think probably those guys deserve more credit for success of the organization. But the organization's playing well anyway. And I'm not dissing our former coaches, but the guys we have now are really a lot better than what we had 4 or 5 years ago. But I don't think there's a secret to identifying them. I think it's a matter of, you know, starting with the front office gossip, trying to find out who's available and who's good and what you can, and then bringing them in and talking through the issues with them.
So we have time for one more. Bill posed a question about the effects of sports on society. Are they measurable? May sound like an academic question, but there actually is at least one practical application I can think of. When a city is arguing, or when a team is arguing for publicly funding a new ballpark, they talk about two things. They talk about the economic impact. Essentially, every study that you'll find says that a ballpark has a negligible impact financially on a city. Maybe a little positive, maybe a little negative, but there's just no reason to think that it's going to increase the city's revenues. The other argument you hear is that it's more amorphous. It's good for the psyche of the city, the civic pride, whatever. And I'm sure here in Boston, you can all relate to that. But maybe there's a way to measure that, the societal impact.
Right. I think the question that I was thinking of has to do in particular with race. There is a well-known professor who competed in the 1968 Olympics, Dr. Harry Edwards, who has written articles decrying the role of athletics in black culture, in African-American culture. It seems to me that he's off his rocker. I'm not an academic. You'll have to apologize. You have to forgive me. I would argue that Bill Russell and David Ortiz and Paul Pierce have done more for race relations in Boston than any other three people you could name. I think in essence that Dr. Edwards is blaming sports for the fact that the rest of society hasn't kept up. Sports, in the world of sports, we really don't care whether you're black or white if you can play. I mean, people pretend that's true, but it's in sports it's really true. And it always was from the time the color lines broke. It seems to me that there has to be a way to study this issue so that we're saying something more intelligent than, I think he's off his rocker. I turned that phone off. I swear I did. I apologize. Is that you, huh? Well, this just proves I don't know how to turn off my cell phone. Sorry. Okay, 7:50.
And one would measure this. Do you have any ideas? Where we go next? I got it. It's Reuben.
Go ahead, Andrew.
I shut it off.
Oh, all right. I think it's larger than sabermetrics. I mean, I've had a very nice career by trying to figure out things that one can study and trying to take what has been an argument sorted out on afternoon talk shows and find a way to study it that moves the ball a couple of inches. What I'm trying to say is that there are still an awful lot of issues that are beyond my ability, and this is one of them. The things that we've studied are not really that relevant compared to the scope of the things that remain to be studied. I mean, there have been articles published recently saying that since everyone now knows the things that we've learned through sabermetrics, the competitive advantage of it has gone. What a fantastically silly idea. I mean, what you're really saying is that we now know everything now. It's like my grade school principal used to tell a story that when he was in college in the 1920s, he had a physics professor who told him, you're lucky to be studying physics now because everything is known now. It's really the same idea that we've learned, we figured everything out now, and now it's just there's no competitive advantage to knowledge anymore. I guess that's really the point I was trying to make.
Okay, now we'll open it up.
So my question is, how much do the sabermetrics actually affect decisions made in clubs? My fear is that a ball club will get a lot of data about a player, look at all of these numbers, and then go, yeah, but he's got a really pretty swing. And is that how it happens in the end? Or will the numbers override people's gut?
Would be all right if I stand. The way you phrase the question sort of assumes that the input of that side isn't legitimate. I mean, but it is. I mean, we're trying to create an organization in which we do look at every number we can find, but we also listen to the guy who says, I don't like his swing. So our assumption is, I don't think that one side overrides the other or should, but I do think that those sort of subjective, disorganized observations are based in knowledge as much as the things that we're doing, and that we don't want to kill one to make the other more dominant.
And I should mention too that a lot depends on which team you're talking about. Almost every team now has somebody whose responsibility is objective analysis. Some teams have more than one. But just to give you an idea, a couple years ago, the Giants had a guy that was his job, statistical analysis. You know how they hired him? He won a contest. So you can imagine how much input he actually had. the Mariners have had two guys like that. And you see where they're at in the standings. Not that it necessarily means anything, but it's just every organization is different. And that balance is up and down, is all over the place. And almost everybody has somebody, but many of those people are not listened to at all.
Hi. Your books also had a big influence on me. I think we're around the same age and the same era. My question is, the impact that you've had has led me to appreciate things like Moneyball, and I kept thinking about, as you're talking, Kevin Euclid, the Greek god of walks. So could you talk a little bit about, say, another example similar to the first question where you had somebody like Jacoby Ellsbury, who's a very valuable player now? How do you balance, sabermetrically or otherwise, do you keep this player, or do you trade him to the Mets for Johan Santana?
It isn't my job to balance them. It's my job to advocate for what I see, and it's Theo's job or the ownership's job to balance them. I mean, it is my responsibility to respect the other side, but it's not my job. You know, I don't make decisions. I just have opinions. I don't worry about it.
Hi. I was watching ESPN the other day, and I noticed that the Yankees' new pitcher hurt himself while running the bases. I wondered whether you agreed with Steinbrenner's comment that the National League should join the 21st century, or whether you thought that baseball should man up and everyone should hit.
Yankee pitcher gets hurt. What's the problem? I don't. You got a problem with that?
I think that I've been for a long time. I've enjoyed having. I mean, to me, differences are interesting, and I would be adamantly against making the leagues have the same rules. I mean, it's bad enough now. Basically, everything's exactly the same except the DH, and I wouldn't be in favor of standardizing things.
And all those little parks in the NL. Boy, is that a shock.
I have a very specific question about. Hello? Okay. About a formula called the Pythagorean expectation.
Right.
I was wondering if you developed that formula that uses runs scored and runs allowed, and how you use that formula. It sounds like you would use it after the fact. It's used to predict winning percentage. I'm just curious to know if you've developed that formula and if you how you use it.
I did develop it, and the Pythagorean expectation states simply that a team's winning percentage will be the relationship between the square of the runs scored and the square of the runs allowed. It is, as you say, a prediction after the fact. Its value is that it states the normal relationship. And that was what I was trying to do. I was trying to find what is the normal relationship between the team's number of runs scored and runs allowed, and that is the normal relationship.
Well, Bill's being too modest. There is a real value there because you can look. It is looking backward, yes, but it tells you something about this team. For example, last year the Mariners were outscored, yet they won, I think, 87, 88 games, which led them to believe they were this close to competing for the division title, which led them to make some moves over this last winter to further that aim. And basically, they've all backfired. Even though Eric Bedard has pitched well for them, he hasn't done them any good. They would have been better off basing their 2008 plans on their 2007 run differential than their 2007 record. Run differential is a better predictor of what will happen than wins and losses.
That's right.
And by the way, 10 years ago, nobody knew about run differential. This wasn't out there, except in the niche things like Bill's books and Baseball Prospectus. Now I do radio, a lot of radio shows, and the hosts know what the run differentials are because we have them, partly because we have them on the standings page at ESPN.com. But I mean, that's just a part of the vernacular now, and it really does lead. It does increase our understanding of what's actually happening on the field and what will happen. I think.
Sure.
A lot of the old-fashioned baseball people, when they look at success in the minors or in college, they look at the age of the player. They say, well, he did great, but he was old for A-ball. Or he wasn't that good, but he was young for AAA. What's your take on all this?
It's certainly a real factor. This is the best answer I can give you, and I'm not sure it will make any sense in this quick a run-through. But this is what I think. What distinguishes good players from bad players is the ability to make progress. When you have a good year at AAA, you have a bad year at AAA at age 21, you have lots of chances left to take that next step forward. When you have that bad year at 26, you're out of time. And the age versus level is overstated by some people, I think. I think that people do get buried who should get another chance, but because they're old for their level, people write off what they do. But it's a timer, and it's a clock measuring whether you this is a person who has time left to take those additional steps forward.
Yeah, and you can get stuck with that label prospect, which is a good thing, or non-prospect, which is a bad thing. I know the Mets have a guy in their minors, Val Pascucci, I think his name is, and the Mets could use a guy like him, but I believe he's 28 or 29, and he just rots away in AAA while, you know, Marlon Anderson is sucking up at bats and they're losing. And I think it's because Pascucci got that label 2 years ago, non-prospect, and that's it.
Analysis do you do? Do you apply introspectively towards your organization after you've picked your team? So let's say, for example, you're going to face Cabrera, or Holiday, Zambrano 6 times this year. Do you, after the first time you face them, statistically, mathematically model your lineup again to see if you change positions and people in your lineup using the information that you have accumulated? Would a different lineup have succeeded better than the lineup that you put on the field? And how many times do you do that throughout your season? I mean, to me, it seems like you just put lineups out based on historical, you know, the best batters, third and the fourth batters, the stronger batter, and so on. But if you juggled those mathematically, how would you come out?
There are two no's in there. One is you ask me what I do, and I don't do that because that's not my job. Terry is supported by people in our front office who help him with lineups, and occasionally he'll ask for my opinion about something, but it is rare. And, you know, that's not my job, and I don't get involved in it. The other thing is that one's ability to increase runs by juggling players, moving players around in the lineup is very limited. I mean, it matters a lot who's in the lineup, but who is where in the lineup is a low-impact decision, and I don't worry about it. However, we do have people who spend a great deal of time and energy reviewing what worked and what didn't work the last time we played a team, so that suppose that we played Baltimore a couple of weeks ago and a given pitcher was getting out Pedroia, we have people who study those at-bats and provide Mr. Pedroia with information that he can use if he feels he can benefit from it about, you know, what happened last time. But it's not my area, and I don't honestly know a whole lot about it.
You talked a lot at the beginning about interesting areas you wanted to do more research on. What's some recent research that you've done that's really interesting and some counterintuitive insights, maybe on batting order itself or defense or something like that, that's maybe a new aha?
I haven't done any interesting research in years. I just did something, and this is the only thing I think of, but I can't tell you what it was. I'm sorry, I don't have a good answer for you.
I do very little research myself, but I do read some. And a couple of things that I saw recently, one was that we think of players, you know, one of the things that we're just sort of beginning to think about is players having dynamic careers in the sense that not only does a player typically go up like this and then down like this at a certain point, but the individual skills that make up that player also have different curves. For example, players defensively, their range is probably best when they're in their early 20s,
right?
22, 23, 24, but their throwing or their positioning may peak at 27. And I think we're just, and pitchers' fastballs may peak at, I think they do peak at in their early to mid 20s. Their curveballs may peak at 29 or 30. All these things are valuable and worth knowing. And we're just starting to even look at the questions, let alone figure them out. But a lot of people are doing work with that right now. The work that's being done, you know, it's funny, a couple years ago when the Red Sox started sucking up smart people and other teams did, I worried that we were going to run out of smart people doing baseball research publicly, the way Bill used to do it. And that hasn't been the case at all. Every time a team hires one of these guys, and a lot of teams are hiring people from who are doing work on the web, two more guys spring up and are publishing research on a website someplace. It's really been fascinating to watch, and it's impossible for me as someone who writes full-time to keep up with it. But if I were working for a team, I would make sure we had somebody who basically their job was just to watch all the stuff that was being published that anybody could read. Because you know what? There's a real edge in that. A lot of teams aren't even bothering to pay attention to that stuff.
Thank you. That was, glad he was here. I'm sorry I gave you such a lousy answer, but he had a better one.
One of the most exciting parts of the game of baseball is the home run. For the fans in the stadium and for the players, to see the couple of seconds it takes for that ball to just go over the fence is very exciting. However, the combination of technology and the media for the fan at home watching the game these days is that there appears to be some radar tracking the ball so that the moment that it's hit, all of a sudden it focuses on a group of fans back in left field, so you miss at home that excitement of seeing the ball's trajectory and being caught. Do you agree that this is in some way diminishing the excitement of the game, and if so, can something be done about that?
It is a real issue, yes. Baseball never worked as well on television as it might have, and I'll give you a similar issue to that. When I started working for the Red Sox, one thing I started to do was document good hustle plays and failures to hustle. But I gave it up after a year because, you know what, the television never catches a failure to hustle. I mean, 90% of the times when you're at a ballpark and you see a player not really running, the television camera doesn't see it. And the reason that's true is that the players fail to hustle in a situation in which it probably doesn't matter. And then something happens that it does matter. But because it probably doesn't matter, the television cameras are never watching them when they do it. So there are just limitations to what you can see of a baseball game on television. And there's probably someday going to be a genius producer who, you know, given the massive size of TV screens today, you could break them down into 9 different pictures and follow the game on segments of the and have 9 perfectly good pictures. There's probably a way to do that where you do see the things you want to see and you get more of the full experience of being at the ballpark, but it's yet to be developed.
Well, I should mention that I mentioned the PitchFX system earlier. They're basically doing the same thing for the entire field. It won't be too long, maybe a year, maybe two, I don't know, when every movement on the baseball field will be documented by a camera. And we're not that far from being able to watch whatever you'd like on your television. So if you want to focus on the shortstop on every play to see how quickly he reacts to a batted ball, you'll be able to do that. Maybe you won't be able to, but whoever has access to the teams will be able to. So we're not that far off from being able to track every player.
And the step from where the teams are able to do it to where the public is able to do it is 2 years.
Yep.
Going back to the question of empowering the fan, how big of a factor is corporate America and corporate money actually? Has it trumped the fan's influence and power within the other factors?
One of the silliest things that sports writers say about sports, about baseball, is that it's not a sport, it's a business. Sports exist because people enjoy them. And when the point is, if the business interests choke out the sporting competition, the whole enterprise dies. It is at its nature a sport around which a business is built, not a business around which a sport is constructed. So I would generally say that, I mean, I'm trying to avoid getting myself fired here. The Red Sox corporate superstructure is very large and very skillful. And it is sometimes perceived by people who work for the team as a bit of a burden. I remember when we signed Daisuke, there was a press conference when we announced we'd signed him, and there was like an 8-hour lead up on TV, 8 hours of TV leading up to the press conference. It could have been perceived as overkill. Sometimes that stuff places a burden on the organization, but it's just part of the engine of success. And in the big picture, I don't think it's possible for the corporate influences to choke out the sporting interest, because if that happens, the whole thing dies.
I think that's right, and I also think that compared to other sports in other countries, we've been pretty lucky. I mean, we don't have logos on the fields or on the uniforms. I think it's a matter of time before that happens, and I think it hasn't happened to this point because Major League Baseball and the other sports they don't want to take the heat from the newspaper columnists. But I complain about it all the time, but I think it could be a lot worse.
I'd like to go back to some of the discussion about players in the minors and development, and particularly around pitchers. I'm curious as to what research is out there in terms of the right way to bring a kid up and through a system. And I think of sort of how the Red Sox handled Clay Buchholz and the exposure they gave him, but the limitations they put on him. And I think of other teams that have far less pitching available so that they might bring their prospects along faster than maybe the Red Sox would want to. And I'm thinking most recently, I guess, of, you know, the Reds putting Homer Bailey out there as a 21-year-old kid, and he's obviously getting batted around, but they're keeping him up even. So I'm wondering what research is out there in terms of the right way to bring up a kid and as a pitcher, how long to stage him at different levels, what kind of exposure to have him.
I think most of those decisions are driven by expertise rather than research. And I think that the Red Sox people who know about those things, you know, we don't mean to be arrogant. We've been fortunate. We're fortunate that we have enough resources that we're in a position where when Clay Buchholz starts to struggle a little bit, we can let him go to the minors and get headed in the right direction somewhere where it's not costing us games. A lot of organizations don't have those resources, and we shouldn't be smug about the fact that we do. The one resource we have is a general manager works with us who used to be a general manager, and a guy works with us who used to be a general manager in another city where he was under quite a lot of pressure to bring pitchers along quickly, and it interfered with his ability to succeed in a very major and direct way. So he's always there to remind us that, you know, you don't want to start doing what we had to do in my old job.
And to answer your question very specifically, I've never seen any research saying that, for example, 100 innings in AAA is better than 50 innings. I don't think that that's been done. If you wanted to do the work, you'd have to solve all sorts of other problems first, which haven't been solved yet.
Well, I have done research that's close to that. I have done research trying to say when pitchers have a minor league track record of this, how long is their adjustment into the major leagues? And it's not something that reshapes the discussion in a dynamic way, but you pick up little nuggets that you can contribute to the general discussion.
I think, and sometimes. What was the conclusion?
If I told you, I'd have to kill you.
So I was afraid of.
Hi, thanks. So you've bemoaned the lack of knowledge and the lack of understanding of all aspects of the game. And you've also emphasized the value of collaboration from many fields that could really inform some of these questions. So my question is, why aren't the teams, making that happen? Why aren't you working together, or maybe you are, with, statisticians, economists, business experts, organizational psychologists, to really be able to address the tough, important questions that you mentioned?
Because I'm a misanthrope and I hate people. it's an overstatement, but there is a lot that could be done by someone who had more skills in working with experts from other fields than I do. I think we are working. We are bringing in a lot of knowledge and expertise from other fields, but it's a slow and human process.
I've heard stories about the Red Sox bringing in people from other disciplines.
We do.
Maybe you can't talk about, but other teams probably not so much. One of the issues that you get into in the front office, and I speak of this as an outsider, of course, is just to give you an example, most teams now are trying to collect more statistical information. Even that is difficult for them to deal with. All of a sudden, we have all this information flowing in from all these different sources. What do we do with it? Teams have to hire people just to get the information in a form where it can be disseminated throughout the organization. We'll now throw into the top of that sociology and psychology and economics. And what is the general manager going to do with all this information?
Right.
What we're going to have, we're already starting to have, is a new generation of general managers who are more comfortable with all these different sources of information. But we're just beginning that process. 10 years from now, most of the GMs in baseball, and in every sport, I think, will have read Moneyball and taken at least some of the fundamental precepts to heart, and will also be comfortable with pulling from different disciplines. But we're just not really very far along that path yet.
Well, that's a really good answer. Thank you. What Theo is really, really good at is generating information flowing toward him from many, many different points and processing that information at a common point. But it is a challenging process. And what I was trying to say before is we can't simply open it up all of a sudden and have a great flood of information flowing toward us that we can't process. We have to systematically create a kind of network feeding toward the decision-making points where we understand what's coming toward us. We're trying to do that, but it's a slow process.
I've been a huge fan of your books and Baseball Prospectus and Moneyball. Yeah, well, for
many years.
for 5 years, I guess. And there are three offensive metric statistics that have really captivated me: value over replacement player, marginal lineup value, and sort of the one that seems sort of the complete package, equivalent and average. And I was wondering, which one do you think is the champion of them? Which one would you say is the best offensive value evaluator?
The value over replacement player is a really good measure. It's not mine, but it's a really good way of looking at the issue of, because it accommodates lots of different types of measurements can be put into a system of evaluating value over replacement players. So that would be mine. Whereas the others you cited are a little more narrow.
Right. I would agree. I use all of them, but I use VORP more than anything. It's something that people can relate to. When you're talking about offense hitting stats or metrics, basically they all work pretty well. Runs created worked well when Bill invented it 20, 25 years ago or more. And I suppose that the newer ones have gotten incrementally better, but basically they all work. So at that point, you're just looking for something that's accessible to people who don't get it in the first place. And VORP, because of the label, people can relate to that immediately. You can actually say that to a non-sabermetrics-friendly person. Value over replacement, that makes sense to me. So that's why I use it more than anything else.
Should Jim Rice be in the Hall of Fame? Yes or no? I know it's kind of the last year, and there's certainly a lot of talk about it and ways to divide up his numbers based on 75 to 85, or he's made the most hits and grounded into the most double plays and made the most outs, yet had the most RBIs. I mean, it seems pretty straightforward to me, but I'm curious as to your take.
Bill will answer this, but he'll have to kill you all.
I wish him well. We're part of the same organization, and I'm rooting for him. That's really all I can say.
I'm not on record as being a big supporter. Great player, great hitter, but not for nearly long enough. Not as good as Dwight Evans. How's that? Or Fred Lynn.
Going along the same lines as the Hall of Fame, what do you think about guys like Roger Clemens or Barry Bonds? Should they be in the Hall of Fame based on what they did before the steroids or anything like that, or the steroid era that we're in?
I'm a big believer in letting the dust settle and discussing the issue after the dust settles. Personally, I don't hold any animosity to Clemens. I have great respect and admiration for Roger Clemens. And Bonds as well. I mean, it seems to me that if you choose to feel cheated by the fact that Bonds or others did the things they did, I can't argue with you. If you choose to feel cheated, that's your right. That's not the way I choose to see it. Bonds is the greatest player I ever saw. He did everything he could to push himself to that level. He had many attributes other than the one people talk about. I mean, he had the most perfect swing I ever saw. He was the most disciplined hitter I ever saw. I'm not angry at him. They don't let me vote for the Hall of Fame, but if I could, I would vote for him. The people who want to spit on their reputation, it seems to me awfully self-righteous. But as I say, if you choose to feel cheated by what he did, I guess that's up to you.
I got basically the same take on that as Bill does, but I don't think that Bonds and Clemens are the interesting cases. But to me, those guys clearly had Hall of Fame talent and Hall of Fame performance, and I believe had that performance before they ever used anything. I think the more interesting cases are going to be the guys who we may attribute their Hall of Fame performances to cheating. And it is cheating, I mean, whether you like it or not, that label. It is cheating. An example that comes to mind is Rafael Palmeiro, who probably wouldn't have been put up Hall of Fame numbers without the great end of career that he had the last 4 or 5 years. Nobody talked about it as a Hall of Famer when he was 34, 35. And if one believes that he wouldn't have gotten there without steroids, I think at least I could see the argument against him being in the Hall of Fame. The problem, of course, is all the unknowables. And not only unknowables in terms of what Palmeiro or someone else is doing, but also the unknowables, what were the pitchers he was facing doing. I think every Hall of Fame voter has to figure that out for himself. I don't think there's a rule that applies to everybody.
One of the issues that's been coming up as of late and baseball is set to meet on it is the maple versus ash bat, and they might actually change the regulations or anything. Do you have a feeling on that? Do you think that may change baseball statistics?
Yes. It's not just people are talking about maple versus ash, but there's actually a series of changes in bat construction that happened in the 1990s. They started kiln drying the bats, which increased the strength to weight ratio. Somebody realized that they started like compressing the bats to make the surface harder. Somebody realized there was no regulation against putting 3 coats of lacquer on the bat, so that it's harder. This led to these very, very hard bats, which explode sometimes on contact, and they're dangerous. And they contributed very heavily to the run explosion. It's entirely possible that they contributed much more to the run explosion than the steroids did. Nobody knows, but it's possible. If something can be done
to get rid of them, I'm all for it. I think it's a better baseball is a better game if you slow the bats down a little bit and you get more balls in play and more contest between base runner and fielder rather than home runs and strikeouts. I think baseball is a better game that way, and I hope something can be done to get those bats out of the game. I don't know whether it can or not, but I hope so.
And you know, it's possible to construct a bat that's wood on the outside, but is a composite material on the inside. Everything's basically glued together, and it doesn't break, but has the same qualities in terms of hitting the baseball as a Louisville Slugger does. And they haven't been approved for the majors. They've been approved for the minors, but nobody really uses them. I'm not sure why, except that baseball players get very attached to their bats, and that's the biggest impediment to any change, is that the players have to go along with any change in the rules about bats, and I don't know that they're real receptive to that, at least not yet.
We want to thank Bill and Rob for sharing their fascinating insights. Thank you again to Mr. and Mrs. John Reno. We look forward to the next Reno Family Foundation Symposium, which will take place this fall, so look for details for that. Please join us downstairs for a reception where you can purchase signed copies of Bill and Rob's books, including the new releases, the Bill James Goldmine and Rob Nair's Big Book of Baseball Legends. And finally, make sure to take home this brochure that talks about some fascinating upcoming free programs that we'll be offering this summer to complement the Baseball as America exhibit, including a program with Joe Castiglione and Kurt Smith, a program with Fenway Park architect Janet Marie Smith, and a program with the just amazing Bill the Spaceman Lee, which you won't want to miss. So bring that home. There's dates and times listed there. So please join us downstairs. Thanks very much.
Thank you.